Hello everyone, welcome to the Local Shop Podcast. This is the final part of our live panel session series from this year's Heart of the Community Conference. And in this session, we'll be talking about the impact of violence and abuse on retailers and their staff, and ways that the justice system should intervene to stop these offences from occurring in the first place. Our panel on this episode is Dr. Emmeline Taylor from City University of London, Joe Rutledge from One Stop, Jane King from Guy's and St. Thomas Hospital, and the Victims Commissioner, Dame Vera Baird.
So, I mean, a number of conversations we've all had in our businesses and we've had as ACS about crime, and I'm really anxious not to just sort of keep saying the same things. I think we don't need to prove how serious an issue this is, but I do want to try and start thinking about solutions and start thinking about how we can take this debate forward. And Joe, I'm going to start with you. You've been out on a roadshow visiting colleagues recently, talking to them about their experiences. What are the issues they're raising most of? Are there any that surprise you? And what's the overarching message you're hearing from your colleagues?
Thank you, James. So first of all, thank you very much for having me here today. And yeah, absolutely. We've been doing some roadshows across our estate in One Stop. So we are a convenience retailer. We have 768 stores across the UK and 188 franchise stores. And we've been doing some roadshows across the UK, so we've gone to the north, the south, the central, where we've brought in our store managers, our regional managers, our area managers. And one of the big parts of that was safety and security, and it was really kind of important for us to speak to our colleagues and deliver them a bit of an update as well about what we're doing in business to help protect them whilst in work. And I think some of the things they face on a day-to-day basis, and I'm sure this will come as no surprise to you, but is challenging thieves, age-restricted sales, and also as well refusing drunk sales. And I know there were three from the ACS report, the three main triggers for violence and abuse in our shops. So they are kind of vulnerable to these types of incidents in our stores, which is really unfortunate. And I think the concerns that they've got around them are quite a mix and quite a variety. They're worried in some senses that that there's not potentially enough youth clubs and youth services in the area. I know that there's been claims within the press that the reduction in police numbers has had an impact on this, a reduction in services, in social services across the UK, an increase in drugs, and an increase in prolific offending as well. So I think it's very difficult to pinpoint one particular reason, but I think the massive change in the environment across the UK over probably the last decade has perhaps had that influence and made it what it is today.
Emily and Joe's got quite a big sort of sample of colleagues to talk to there, but obviously you've talked to and analysed evidence from many, many more. How does what Joe's talked about there tally with the research that you've done into, I suppose, the incidents of crime, but also to some extent causes of crime?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, James. I think Joe does pick up some really important points there around what the causation or causal factors are around violence and also verbal abuse in convenience stores across the country. There's lots of figures and statistics that are bandied around, so from the British Retail Consortium, from the Home Office Commercial Victimisation Survey, from Us Doors Freedom From Fear campaign, and of course from the ACS. And I think one of the issues has really been around trying to humanise this data. I think all too often it's too readily dismissed as a problem for businesses, a problem for retailers to deal with themselves. And so I was commissioned by the Co-op to do a study to really bring to life the stories of shop workers that had encountered quite severe physical attacks and also sustained verbal abuse. And it was really quite shocking, the findings from that particular study. So listening to these accounts from individuals who had often more than once been punched or stabbed or threatened with dirty needles, they were told were infected with HIV. They'd been lacerated with smashed bottles, they'd been kicked, they'd been hospitalised. And these physical injuries, of course, are very real and very concerning. But what was most astounding for me doing this research was that whilst the physical injuries might heal, the real issue here was the long-term mental health consequences that were all too often being left unresolved. So that was a real outcome from this particular study. Now, there is, as Joe has said and James has alluded to, there's four main scenarios that my research revealed were almost like triggers in which violence and verbal abuse were being generated from, and that is, of course, encountering shoplifters. It was age-related sales and the prohibition of other items. Shop workers now have more than 50 products that they have to uphold the law around. So that was in the Licensing Act 2003. The Offensive Weapons Act has now introduced even more items. There's hate-related incidents that are at their highest since the 2016 referendum. And then, of course, armed robbery, where an individual deliberately goes in with the intent of causing fear, if not physical harm. But those scenarios, in many respects, have always been around. Shop workers have always been on the front line of upholding legislation. They've always encountered shoplifters. But we've seen a real sea change in recent years. So something has changed. The rates and severity of physical attacks are at their highest level ever. And that, I think, can be pinpointed back to around 2010. And the reasons behind that, the causality that sits behind these scenarios, I would say, is around this long-term disinvestment as part of austerity. So we know that mental health, we know homelessness is at its highest rate currently. We know that there's been disinvestment in alcohol and drug services, in youth services. It doesn't paint a particularly pretty picture. But in concert, we've also seen a reduction in the number of police officers and the amount of funding for police officers. And I think it would be folly to dismiss the severe impact that that has around levels of reporting and then also confidence that a police officer is actually going to respond, particularly when we've essentially seen the decriminalisation of shop theft of less than £200. So I'm sure there's many people in the room that have concerns around that 2014 change in legislation. So I guess just to summarise, because there is lots of different factors, and I think hopefully throughout this session more detail will be provided to these. But lastly, I think there's also, we have an ineffective criminal justice system currently. So not only did I interview victims, I interviewed offenders, and many of them say that they simply have a revolving door of prison, short custodial sentences, 4 to 6 weeks. One individual I spoke to had been in prison more than 30 times. We need to tackle the root causes of their criminality. It's almost too late at the time it's sentencing them to prison. So I'd like to see more investment in rehabilitation, diverting people away from criminal justice and actually tackling the root causes of their offending behaviour.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Emmeline. Jane, I want to come to you and ask you to talk about some of the issues in convenience stores in our sector. How does this tally? What are the similarities and the issues that you face in hospital environment?
Thank you. Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay, good. It appears that my picture is not good enough for the panel, so we'll have a word about that later. So security and healthcare, to say it's challenging is probably an understatement. So just give you a little bit of context. So head of security for Guy's and St Thomas's. So St Thomas's, when you have drinks later, for those of you go in, you'll look across the river and you'll see us there in all of our glory. So that's St Thomas's, and then we have Guy's Hospital at London Bridge. So we are central London and St Thomas's in the government security zone. And we have 17,100 staff, and we see 2 million patients a year. So we just need to have some context around numbers. Interesting what Emily was saying, because we've seen the increase. I've been in the health service since 1991, so I have seen it. But we have always had violence, because it's always kept me employed. Is that someone trying to leave?
Right.
Yeah. So it's always been there, but without doubt, it has certainly escalated. For me, a pivotal period when we saw massive escalation was 2016. You can make what you want of that about what was happening around 2016. But what we did see was a huge increase in violence. And in the health service, we recalled physical violence and non-physical violence. And then there are subcategories out of that. And we saw a huge increase in hate crime. And also we saw a huge increase in antisocial behaviour, not necessarily physical, but non-physical. And actually sometimes the non-physical is as wearing or more wearing on our staff than the physical assault. And absolutely right, that someone physically assaulted, it's not just about the physical injury, it's about people's mental health and their welfare afterwards. But the non-physical is as draining and psychologically as damaging. Okay, and as an organisation, we need to think about how we look after our staff in that way. So we've had several campaigns, and we revised the campaign in 2016. And fairly much like Joe said, you have to engage with the staff. So it looks like that our strategies are similar. But just because, you know, what you are experiencing in the shops is no different to what we are experiencing in hospitals. So everyone will think about A&E on a Saturday night. Our busiest time and our highest pinch point for violence will be a Monday afternoon, starting about 5 o'clock. So we look at the data and we look at what can we do. So is it around staffing? We know that that's when we get the most patients in. So how can we move people through the system? We redesigned our A&E, working with the design council. And so our A&E doesn't represent the traditional model. So if you think of A&E, most people think of a square room where you go in and you wait 4 hours, if you're really lucky, and you see everything kicking off around you. So we've redesigned it, and we've gone with the colours and the soft tones and the TV. Do not put Jeremy Kyle on, OK? That's that's never going to end well. But it's about some low-level noise going on. And then we process people through the system. So it was based on the patients and looking at their footfall. And as long as people think they are in the system, so they move from triage and they move to reception and they move to urgent care and they move, people believe they're in the system. But if they're in one place, okay, then they believe that they've been lost. So lots of work for us to do. But crime and violence in particular is still increasing. So we launched a campaign in 2016. We did the same 2017 and 2018, and I can talk about those later. And I'm rewriting the policies, and we are going to relaunch in 2019. Whatever you decide, okay, one thing isn't going to fix it. It's an ongoing process, and it's ongoing, and it's about supporting staff. And just to add, the back end of it is that you need, if staff are involved, you need to make sure you debrief them and you offer them access to the services to help them get back to work.
Brilliant. Thank you, Jane. Good to hear that. Obviously, well, difficult examples given, but the similarities between the issues that your colleagues are facing and our colleagues are facing, so we learn from each other. Dame Vera, I want to come to you, and congratulations on your recent appointment as Victims Commissioner. And sadly, you've heard accounts first-hand and second-hand here already today from victims of crime. What are you hearing more widely in terms of what victims of crime are saying they want you and the government to do? What action are they looking for?
I don't think you should put me and the government in the same sentence. In the sense that I am independent. That's my hallmark. So I'm appointed to protect and promote the interests of victims and witnesses, and that means that I have to chase the government quite a lot of the time. I have no powers, so the statute which set my post up says that I am to promote the interests of victims and witnesses, to support and assist everything in relation to that, and to keep the victims' code under review. And that is what I'm to do, and that's where it stops. So I have only my voice and my lobbying abilities and my determination to make alliances with people who are victims so that I have, you know, a powerful lobby which I can use to try to fetch change to fulfill my role. I wanted to say at the outset that, you know, I can really just top off by agreeing with all that Joe and Emmeline said, and that experience from Guy's is very clear as well. There is a fairly recent survey by Usdaw, who do a survey of shop workers every year, and certainly from their 2019 survey, they see a 37% increase in 1 year of people they surveyed who were threatened, and they find a 38% increase of those who were threatened, and a 25% increase of those who were abused and assaulted. I don't know how wide their survey is. Chances are it's in the co-op if it's Usdaw, but I don't know. But that is a very telling figure because it means that whatever has been done in the past isn't curbing what's going on. The reasons why crime generally is on the increase are obviously Delphic deep and hard to probe, but I couldn't agree more that austerity is inevitably a key part of this over such a long period of time. Gradually easing away resources that were there until they are depleted beyond any worth. So youth services in particular, I really lament that the local authorities have had such cuts that they have been unable to stay in youth services. I was a police and crime commissioner and we tried to kind of patch up and add bits here and there, but of course they PCCs have a small budget and about 98% of it has to go to running the police. They have a victims budget too, which I'll come to in a minute. So there's no prospect of making that up. But, you know, children being excluded from school, children not having enough to do, children not having hope, not having the optimism that I, you know, a child of the 60s and 70s, grew up believing that all was progress, that there were endless possibilities. Homelessness, you're right, but hopelessness, I think, a very telling factor indeed. And I wouldn't doubt that post-2016, which was the referendum, has brought greater risk because division, as it's bred in our country, lends itself, you know, at the edges to almost legitimised aggression. And so you can see a whole syndrome, I think, there. I also agree that the court service, the CPS and the police, who have also all suffered the most massive cuts, are very significantly depleted. And so police in some areas won't go out to shoplifting up to a particular level of money. I know the PCC for Bedfordshire said when it was made clear that they wouldn't, I don't remember if it was 300, 500, that the police were not going to attend because they just couldn't, compatible with their obligations to victims of sexual offences and emergencies and so on. She expected to become the shoplifting centre of the country. Now, I don't know if that's been fulfilled, but she's not in a greatly different position, although she made it public from very many other forces who don't have that kind of resource to give a priority to. Prosecution rates, I'm sure you'll have read that in rape they've depleted massively, but in everything they are down at levels of 3, 4, 5% of complaints that are made. The courts, there is a survey currently that the Criminal Bar Association is carrying on where every day their membership go to court and they ring in and say at Snaresbrook there are 8 courts there and only 3 of them are sitting. And that's the same all across the country, so they're carrying out a survey of that. So crime is increasing, prosecutions are going down, and the courts are not being able to be effective. I would only differ from my two colleagues to the right about the significance of physical injuries as opposed to psychological injuries, to saying that in my view the psychological impact is far, far bigger from a relatively minor injury from the physical injury. Of course, a serious injury is in a different category. But the level of undermining of self-esteem which follows from being attacked, particularly attacked in a place you've got to go back to the following morning or within a week and do your job again, the sense that your safety has been undermined, your fear that it's going to happen any minute, your guilt that you didn't manage it in some different way, are all things that people just need to be supported to get over. And impacts of crime on individuals are at that level still very significant. Of course, as you go up the gravity of crime, the impacts become longer term, more profound, post-traumatic, and the National Health Service now envisages the need for lifelong counselling for some people who've been affected by a high level of crime. But even what looks like minor crime is capable of having a very profound effect. And this is the staff who are working in your shops who have no choice but to go back. The choice of somebody who's been hurt is not to go back where they've been before. And yet your staff have to do it. So there is a huge job to do. To try and prevent it or to try and have it dealt with, well, I mean, looking at a traditional way in which you would seek to do that would be to make the court better and to make sentencing, as I say, Emmeline has said, different at any rate, but probably harsher, I don't know. We were talking outside about the emergency workers legislation and that Chris Bryant took through the House of Commons, which adds an aggravating element to a sentence because it's an emergency worker. You're in a position, your staff, where they are in effect implementing the law, because it is those high points when you have to refuse people drink because they're underage or where they're already intoxicated, and other regulations that you have to implement, which Emmeline's obviously surveyed in depth. That really means that they need to be brought in the eyes of the courts and the police into an analogous position with emergency workers. Mm-hmm. They are not in that analogous position in anybody's vantage point now, because they're just seen as part of a business, mm-hmm. you know, not part of a public service, not an emergency worker, and so in a sense we, you know, down the pole of worthiness. But I think if you can, first of all, encourage everybody who is attacked, whose position is responded to by the police and the CPS, to insist on doing a victim personal statement about the impact it has on them. Usdaw found that only about 43% of shop staff do victim personal statements. Then you can say in that, what happened to you, how you feel about it, and you can reiterate that you were there in course of a duty which the public wish you to fulfil, and that is exactly what you were doing at the time. And I don't necessarily, you know, have a 100% faith in increasing sentences, but that level of definition of the role that, you know, the predicament that a shop worker is put into regularly seems to me to be an important one to bring before the courts. And also it is a very key part of restoring the self-esteem of a person who has suffered either a physical attack or a psychological one. People feel diminished by it. They need to be told that society accepts that they have been wronged and is doing its best to put it right. And a victim personal statement, when the court reads it and says, we've seen that and we understand this is bad, that is a huge building block toward bringing them back. That's a kind of traditionalist approach, but I think it's where my mind's going at present.
Yeah, that's a very important first step. I mean, we've talked about the problem, sadly. We have to, and that's part of the subject. Thinking about some solutions now, so I want to sort of maybe go down the panel this way, asking firstly about things we want government or police and crime commissioners or courts or the police. So, you know, one thing we'd like to see others do, and then we'll do it again, and we'll talk about what retailers and businesses could do. So, Joe, what do you want to see other people doing?
So I think, I mean, as far as kind of your police, your government, etc., I think what we've done recently in completing the call for evidence, which we've taken part in, is kind of highlighted how big the issues are across the estate. And we've just seen we're seeing the bill going through Parliament, the Scottish Parliament's at the moment, to protection of retail workers, as my colleagues just discussed. And I think it is taking it to that level. It does, our retail workers in our stores, they do need that extra level of protection. They do need that. But it needs to be tailored as well. It can't always be a sentencing or a bigger fine.
Yeah.
We've got to be identifying the root cause of these incidents. And if somebody's offending in the shops or abusive in the shops or they're violent in the stores because of drugs or alcohol addiction, then simply giving them a fine or sending them to prison isn't going to be the right sentence for them. So I think there's a lot more that needs to be going on in the background. We really rehabilitation works. Mm-hmm. And especially even around the things like social care and things like that, just giving them other opportunities. Yeah. So instead of just a kind of, it's a fine or...
which probably doesn't get paid anyway.
That longer sentence.
More intelligent sentencing and...
Yeah, and I mean, we have invested significantly in technology across One Stop, and we've done a massive piece on changing the culture in our business around focusing on safety and security and protection for our colleagues, which is working really well for us as a business. Mm. So we're really kind of landing that message with the colleagues just to kind of give them that extra bit of protection in the shops, whether that be the physical equipment or training, collaborating with them, sharing intelligence with them, updating our policies. But again, I think it's really key that it's not just done at the store level, but it's got to be done at that higher level as well. And that's why things like that bill and the call for evidence are really important, because there needs to be more protection for our retail stores.
Emmeline, what's the one thing? I talked about sentencing and rehabilitation.
Yeah. Do I only get one?
You can do two. Two's good.
But very brief ones. Of course, there needs to be broad brush, I think, changes and societal changes and investment in communities that is so severely lacking, I think, in current years. But if there were the more immediate changes that I think would really result in impactful changes around violence in shops. One is around reporting. So even though we've got these staggering statistics, the commercial victimisation survey, the government's own figures show that physical attacks have tripled just in the past 2 years. But we also know there's severe levels of underreporting. So this is simply the tip of the iceberg. So we need to encourage shop workers to report. And the only way that's going to happen is if they have confidence that the police are going to turn up. How do you get confidence that the police will turn up? It needs to be in the policing strategic plans, but it won't feature there if all of these reports aren't collated and this issue is really pushed back to them to say this, you know, we need to have a better response. Leading on from that, a post-implementation review of the Antisocial Behaviour, Crime and Policing Act in 2014. That's the legislation that essentially decriminalised shop theft of less than £200. That's now a summary-only offence. The police only have to pursue it if the offender is known, and even once that offender has been pursued, they can simply plead guilty by post. I don't think that's an effective criminal justice system, and offenders are simply saying they have licence to steal. That's the number one trigger for violence in shops, is encountering a shoplifter. So we need to deal with the huge levels, huge increases in shop theft that are being experienced. And 70% of those shop thefts are committed by individuals with a class A drug addiction, or they have alcoholism. So we know substance misuse is very much correlated with violence and verbal abuse. I would suggest that there is a test on arrest approach for police, and then you divert these individuals into meaningful rehabilitation. We know that this revolving door of prison is simply not effective. We know that giving fines to individuals who are drug affected, who are homeless, who have mental health issues, simply does not impose any deterrent to these individuals. Those fines simply go unpaid. It's not an effective response. So testing on arrest, divert to rehabilitation, I think we'd really see some quick wins in that respect. So I think that was my three or four points there. But yeah, they'd be
all great points, all things that we'd like to see taken forward. Dame Vera, I think, I mean, your views on this, and particularly from the point of view, you used to be a police and crime commissioner, so you've seen some of the things that have maybe worked or not worked in that respect. What should we be expecting from the system as a whole, perhaps particularly PCCs?
I'd like to pick up on that underreporting. A very key point to encourage reporting is that the employer will support reporting it too. And I don't think that people are always convinced that that is what's wanted. When I was a police and crime commissioner, there were certain stores, certain large company stores in the Northeast who didn't want the police to come at all into the store because they wanted the store to have a family atmosphere. They would not have welcomed it if somebody who wasn't badly hurt made a complaint, because they didn't want that atmosphere undermined. There were also some stores in Northumbria when I was the PCC, and remember that's confined geographically to where it is, who were very well provided with, first of all, staff, and also with protective mechanisms, you know, CCTV, pictures of a 6-foot policeman in the doorway, remarkably effective, surprisingly, and lots of other things. And then those who didn't have those and perhaps had a person on duty on their own with lines of shelves which you couldn't see down and didn't have CCTV for, where the shoplifting level was significantly higher and the police were very reluctant to go because they didn't feel that they should be making up for what they saw as a lack of investment in appropriate overheads by the shop owner. So you can see there are tensions around that whole question of increased reporting, but they do have to be sure, if people are going to make that kind of report, that the police will come. Mm-hmm. And they are not going to be able to come for a £200 shoplifting. They really are not. There may be a no... if someone's hurt, different thing. And I thought, actually, that was the sort of essential topic we were talking about here. They will always go if somebody is hurt and that person wants it reported and their employer agrees. And it isn't, to be fair to the courts, you know, there's been test on arrest for 15 years. When I became a police and crime commissioner, my chief constable wanted to stop test on arrest for drugs because she was testing the same people over and over again. And they were saying to her, well, we're already going to whatever the local drug treatment place was, and so why are you asking us to do another test? You know, we're on our way out of this, whether they were or not. But test on arrest does still go on, and people do get referred for treatment. The courts would say, to be fair to them, that they don't just put people on fines, put people on things that are completely unrelated to what's causing their criminality, that hopefully now, rather more effectively, if the probation service is going to be restored to the public sector where it was effective, then the courts will at least stand down a case for a report from a probation officer who will tell them what the issues are with the individual, and they will try to do their best to put them on a community programme which will try to wean them off what they do. The fact is that they get to a stage in the courts where, magistrates tell me all the time, they have tried and tried and tried and tried and they end up with no results, and so they end up sending people on short prison sentences. And I couldn't agree more that that's a waste of time. And I have to say that the fact that magistrates have put people on repeat programmes doesn't mean that those repeat programmes have gripped them, doesn't mean that they've made a change, and so probably they need to carry on. Diversion. Well, you need to ask the victim what they think about diversion, because to a lot of victims that looks like a let-off. And they don't want to be ignored. So your employees who have been assaulted might not think that it's sufficient for somebody to be given a conditional caution or drug tested in the police station and put on bail on condition that they go to a drug treatment centre and then get a let off at the court because they're already engaged with a drug treatment centre. And bear in mind that that does happen, that people who are already on drugs orders, already in drug treatment, may be looking like people who are getting fined wrongly, but actually since they're already on the programme, the magistrates haven't got anything else they think to do, and they can therefore just fine. It is an enormously complicated problem, but I think that the real key here is to give your employees some prominence amongst other victims, because they are in the way of criminality in a way that most of us aren't.
Okay, thank you. Jane, so things that, well, especially in your environment, things that you were looking for help from outside agencies, police and so on, but also many things you did yourselves. What were the key things you took forward to address this challenge?
For us, and it's interesting to hear the statistics, so 2016, we had a 27% increase in assaults. And then with the campaign that we ran, it increased the next year by 28%. You could say that that's the result of a good campaign because we're increasing reporting, etc. And you've got to understand what the problem is before you can actually put a strategy in place to deal with it. So that we saw as a positive. But we did work with our staff and we empowered our staff. Okay. And the, we went away from the traditional models of staff posters with black eyes and cut lips, etc., or the handcuffs. And we went for the emotive story. So healthcare is an emotive business. Most people don't want to go to hospital. So, you know, and emotions run high. We have a children's hospital at St. Thomas's. So, you know, people are dealing with high-end emotions. And we have to understand that. But we also have to understand that we have to protect our staff. The point I do want to make is that people who misbehave in hospitals or healthcare premises are the same people that are coming into your shops. Okay? So we need to be thinking of some strategies. I agree with the point that we need more resources, we need more rehabilitation, we need to look at the substance misuse on people and actually what programmes we can give them, because short prison sentences don't work. I think everyone knows that. But also for us, we have a real problem with patients who have an underlying mental health condition, and actually for the mental health beds. So we are an acute trust, okay, so we have an A&E, etc. We are not mental health specialists, but we are seeing more and more mental health patients who are coming in and will be in some form of crisis. And we're having to deal with patients who are in crisis. So we would like to see more resources for dealing with people with mental health issues. But a point that I do want to make is just because people have an underlying mental health condition, and I'm not a clinician, okay, this is a personal view, doesn't mean that they lack capacity at all times. Okay, so the police will say, oh, well, mental health, we don't want to deal with it. It, you know, just because someone has underlying mental health doesn't mean they don't have capacity at all times. Only a clinician can make that assessment. Okay, and one of the things that Dame Vera touched on earlier, one of the real powerful tools for our staff is the victim personal statement. So, you know, I agree, sometimes when we go to courts, we don't actually get the result that we think that we should, and sometimes it's a challenge to get people to the courts. But allowing the member of staff to have the victim personal statement actually does give them some form of closure, if you like, along with the fact that we do the debrief. We do try and have some organisational learning from that. What can we do? What did we do well? What didn't we do so well? And what can we do better? What can we do to protect our staff at all times? Because if we have our good staff, then we will deliver good patient care.
I mean, I think the bits and personal statements definitely a thing to take from the session. Just one final comment from you, Joe, in terms of people going back to their businesses, as you will after the day, engaging with people on the shop floor. What's the message you'd want everyone here to give to their colleagues in terms of support, in terms of policies, in terms of process? What's the thing you're always trying to drum into the team?
I think, especially from our kind of view within the retail sector, I think the key message for us is it's about safety first, it's about you first, and I know there's a lot of issues that can happen within the shops and there's a lot of frustration out there in the business as well, but it really is about you as the individuals in the shops. You're the ones that are in the store, your safety comes first, and that's kind of the key message from me.
Yeah, really important message to finish with. So would everyone thank the panel of Joe, Emmeline, Dame Vera Baird and Jane.